Senate State Affairs come order. It's 9 a.m. on the, I believe it's the 19th of March, 2015. We have members present, Senator Wilikowski, Senator Huggins, and Stoltz. We have a quorum to do business. Today we have confirmation hearings, appointees from Governor Walker to various boards, commissions, and state departments. And then we'll continue. Hopefully, we can get through this in the first 45 minutes. We'll have the remaining portion to finish the public testimony, to, or at least initiate the public testimony on the statute and the amendment relating to known as countermand. With that, we're starting with the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission. Mr. Ruprecht, you're up first. Welcome, Mr. Mayor, Mr. Commissioner, esteemed citizen of Wasilla.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You want me to start, Senator Stoltz?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you. My resume is before you. My name is Vern Ruprecht. I'm a resident of the city of Wasilla. I've been asked to come on board the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission in the state of Alaska. My background is I'm a 1969 graduate from high school. I enlisted in the United States Air Force in 1970, served approximately four years, with a tour in Southeast Asia. Subsequent to that, I obtained a two-year associate's degree in law enforcement management administration. After that, I worked during the pipeline, twisting wrenches in an auto or a truck rebuild shop in Anchorage. Then I completed my bachelor's degree in criminal justice at the University of Alaska in 1981. Went to work for the department, or the original Division of Corrections, during its transition to departmental status. I worked as a state probation and parole officer, corrections officer, and then back into the tour as a probation officer in the institutions. I left the Department of Corrections in 1988. I went back into the United States Army Reserve, where I'd been. I was commissioned out in 19, and my resume is 1 year off, 1978 in February, in Armor Cav. I went to Fort Knox, Kentucky for the summer of 1989 to complete my advanced courses. I left from there and went to Creighton University School of Law, graduated in 1992, returned to Alaska, and I practiced law ever since. I worked for the law firm of Stepovich, Kennelly, and Stepovich in Anchorage for the first 6 years. Then I opened my own practice in Wasilla. In 2008, I ran for the manager of the city of Wasilla. I did that for two terms until I was termed out in October of 2014. I took a little time off. My oldest daughter came home from the Army for the first time in 14 months, which I enjoyed. And then I went to work, and it's not on the resume, for a month's time as an in-house counsel to the Zipper Medical Group, which is four clinics in the state and expanding out to Nevada, to help them to reorganize and as he's building that corporation. I got a call. I was asked if I would come on since I put in a letter of intent to the commission. I terminated my employment with the Zipper Medical Clinics, and I'm here before you today.
Questions for Commissioner Ruprecht? Senator Huggins.
Yeah, Ms. Ruprecht, when for this function, what would you put as your top three qualities as being qualified, if there is such a thing, for this position?
Well, the three commissioners of the commission are administrative law judges for the state of Alaska. And in the years I practiced law, I've done administrative law. I think that qualifies me in that area to follow what's required, do the proper analysis legally, and come to a reasoned decision with the other commissioners to help avoid the possibility of triggering appeals that may not work well for the commission in the end. Before the state Supreme Court once it goes through its judicial reviews. I also have the background in management, and we're looking at the commission, and it's been around nearly 42 years now, and the question becomes, is it actually meeting its goals today in the 21st century in a more modern Alaskan fishery? And I think probably with the analysis that needs to be applied to it from a managerial point of view, we really need to take a look at possible consolidation, some reorganization, or some restructuring in that process. I note that the Magnuson-Stevens Act is also going through the same review now to ensure that there's an economic viability of the fisheries in the future here off of Alaska's waters. The third thing is, I always make my appointments. I get to work on time, and I usually put in extremely long hours.
Yeah, thank you,
Senator Huggins.
Mr. Chairman, I think you alluded to it at a point in your testimony, but could you address, if you desire, I've seen several documents and some saying question the workload in this case or the need for, and I saw something that indicated the department having a leaning one way or the other, but could you just help the rest of the members?
Sure, Senator, I didn't mean to cut you off through the chair. In less than about 2 months that I've been with the agency, you know, I've really drilled down into the history of the agency, its background, and its functions. And right now, there's still approximately 28 cases unresolved. The issue with that is that a proper analysis is that the resolution of those cases is necessary. If we look back in history, when commercial fisheries was first put into place, there was a vote of the people of the state of Alaska to amend the Constitution, Article 8, Section 15, to provide for it. And then Governor Egan transmitted a 23-page letter over to then President Terry Miller. And that vote passed by 78%. People realized they needed to do it. And to get closer to your question, Senator, when they envisioned creating it, they knew they needed to make it an independent agency. And I say that based on what I can see in the history, is it's more defensible to defend a regulation than it is a complete legislative scheme or a statutory scheme, because it then becomes a piecemeal thing. And this is the workload in the agency. We're reviewing that right now, and that's going to take a little bit of time from a managerial point of view. But it's a sure bet there's a good possibility there's going to be new fisheries coming up for closure in the state or limited entry, because there's an awful lot of pressure and a lot of burden on the Alaska fisheries. And I think it's incumbent upon us to take it in a measured direction to make sure we just don't, to coin the phrase, throw the baby out with the bathwater all at once, and that we come up with a fundamental realignment and management plan to ensure that we're doing what we need to do for the 21st century to protect these fisheries. Some people have asked me, I mean, are they just people sitting at their desks staring at the computers? Well, it's always been my want. I walk into the agency every morning and I go past every cubicle, past literally every employee, and I don't see a whole lot of frivolity. That's a very busy place, and it can be very busy, especially during permitting time, licensures, and then whoever's been denied it, that triggers the reviews that need to go forward. But the one mission it does do is it's very quick in permitting interim permits to keep gear in the water, to keep Alaska fishermen fishing because of the economic necessity for many of them to stay on the job. And so we look at it from that point of view, and I can understand why it's standing out there as a standalone agency. Because if we look at Fish and Game and the Board of Fish, they serve three masters in this. They serve the commercial fishermen, the subsistence commissioner, fishermen, and the sports fishermen. Our agency is the only one that actually, once there's an allocation that comes forward, by our own rules and by our regulations, decide who gets to fish it. And so that the Fish and Game is not in that unique position, neither is the Board of Fish, because it may raise a conflict. I mean, who are you really favoring? Is it going to be sports, assistance, or commercial? They look at, you know, the economic viability, but then there's the allocation made, and that's where we step in. And we stand alone from that because we only deal with the commercial end of it. And so, to answer the question, to get right to it, that's why I think it's necessary that we spend a little bit of time, myself and the other two commissioners, and take a hard look at the realignment of the management and the functions and the mission of Commercial Fisheries and Recommission at this time, to bring it more in line.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, and just another one. To include myself, if somebody asked me, where do I go to find this commission, What's the room number of the building? I go, God, that's a hard question. Never thought of it. So if someone asked that tomorrow in March, where would it be? And if we asked the same question in July, where would it be? That you hang your hat and somebody says, I see these guys at work and they're working hard.
Well, right now, Senator, and they've been down in the Jordan Center at the other end of Juneau for a very long time. Most of the commercial fishermen know exactly where it is because they have to do business with it on an annual basis. If it moves, it moves, and I guess there have to be a public broadcast to tell people where it's gone. So,
yeah, no, I wasn't alluding to moving. Does it move with the capital? Is that what you're saying? No, I'm joking.
Well, that I'm sure there's
been
a lot of people.
No, I'm being flippant. But I'm sure. I mean, you live where?
Wasilla.
So how do you live in Wasilla and work in Juneau?
It's almost like a slope job, Senator. Right?
What I'm asking you, I'm innocently ignorant on because I have little idea about what you're describing, but I think it's important, at least for the record, that people understand that. But your meetings and your get-togethers are here, or do you kind of migrate around the state, or is that not required?
I've never known it to be required, you know, and it's interesting that I saw the United Fishers Alaska, and a report came out in Bristol Bay, news article, that it seems the bulk of the commercial fishermen now live in Anchorage. And, you know, the agency does not have a commissioner in that area, nor an office in that area. So, you know, who knows, under reorganization there may be a need to put commissioners in different pieces of the state to be more responsive to the needs of the commercial fishing industry.
Mr. Chairman, one more question. I mean, you described the food chain that fish migrate through and people want to get them and eat them. All right, so if we start at the head of a river where the last person eating them probably is a bear because they're starting to deteriorate, and you go back to where commercial fishermen are catching them, what parts of that, and more importantly, after, let's just say, the entry part of it for commercial fishing, in doing your job, what is your cross-coordination with the Board of Fish and other agencies that look at the fish, the department, as they're heading through that food chain?
Well, it's certainly an interfacing and interconnective research project that comes with our agency for our research, also with the Board of Fish and the Fish and Game Department, so that they can get some idea about what kind of escapement there is, what kind of, you know, fisheries will come up, how strong they'll be, what is the economic viability of it, how far do they think they can actually let that resource go before it gets into a diminishing return. So from what I understand, there's this interconnectivity between all three, essentially.
And so let me ask specifically, I think everyone that has paid attention to fish recently would say king salmon in trouble. So what is your role in addressing king salmon in trouble?
Well, I'll just hazard a guess at that, in that the Commercial Fisheries Any Commission, I believe in FY14, brought in $7.8 million in funds, and it costs about $4.4 to run it. $3.1 million of that's taken off and goes over to Comfish in the Fish and Game Department. And they're the biologists. They're the ones that have to really kind of sort out that problem and then tell us, okay, we know there's this much fish out here for the commercial industry, or we think this much fish. And then we have to look at what's sustainable and what's an optimum number, or a number that can actually get the gear in the water and keep it economically viable. I wish I had the answer to what's going on with the kings, with the Chinooks. I mean, I just have no idea. I mean, we've seen days and years where they were really strong, and then there's been crises, and God only knows.
Yeah, no question. Thank you.
I can tell you, Senator Huggins, one of the things we did, it wasn't exactly with a lot of complicity or agreement with CFEC. We've taken several million dollars of CFC funds, and there's a King Enhancement Project going on at the Eklutna Tail Races. Wasn't necessarily heartily endorsed. We didn't check with the Seattle folks either, but it was certainly an available revenue source to enhance our ability. So they didn't offer it up, but it was certainly something that policymakers saw as an appropriate source. So unbeknownst to the CFC folks, they have helped a little bit on King enhancement. I do have a question. You hold, you have a lot of constituency in the northwestern states. You hold hearings there. What's your outreach to make sure your CFEC constituency is attended to?
I cannot answer that question, Mr. Chair.
You think we should?
I think we should, absolutely.
Hold hearings in Seattle and...
Well, you mean the northwest states themselves. I thought I misunderstood. I was thinking of the northwest Alaska coastal area where there's growing fisheries and there's fisheries out there. Seeing is that the Alaska fishing industry actually supplies $1.6 billion to the economy of the greater Seattle area. I think we ought to have some kind of presence with those folks down there, because there's always been this tension and this competition with Alaskan waters, and we know historically a lot of the salmon runs got into that problem because of the major fish traps and the processors back in the old days, so to speak. There was over 5 million cases of fish a year being sent out of the territory of Alaska, and then it diminished down to about 2 million. And it just kept collapsing in on the state of Alaska or the territory at that time.
And I have an anecdotal question. You probably won't know the specific, but it really has to do with controls and who's running things. I have a friend up until the last year or two was a lifelong resident, multi-generational Alaskan. I think I'm very proud that he, when he moved outside, he made sure he applied for an out-of-state residency. First thing that happened is he got a Carlson reimbursement. And that's a big concern. If we have a zeal to make sure we take care of our Seattle and other state fishermen, that we're firing off checks to make... boy, that really bothered me that that person got a... who had been a long-time multi-generational Alaskan, very embedded in Alaska society, and when he files for his out-of-state resident fishing license, to actually exhibiting a lot of integrity, he probably could have floated on that, as many of them do, he gets a Carlson reimbursement check. And the Carlson is where the out-of-state commercial fishermen zealously sued and demanded a large payment. And Senator, the now U.S. Senator, then Attorney General Sullivan, led in the state's efforts and successfully negotiated and fought that down to a less egregious amount. But boy, I have no doubt the veracity of this person's claim, and I'd sure like a report on if we're firing off a check to an out-of-state resident, if that's our default position, let's pay the people from out-of-state. Boy, that is very, very troubling. We've already given them millions, and they were asking for tens of millions originally. I know the zeal of the three attorneys there will probably want to jump right on this. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know you've only been there a couple months, and please don't take this the wrong way, but these are concerns that I've raised in resources. And I grow more concerned because I'm not seeing the legislature take any action in terms of the budget. And there's a review that came out, which was implemented and performed under the Parnell administration, signed off on by the Walker administration, Fish and Game Commissioner. And it's, I guess critical would be a generous word. It talks about the employees. There's 32 employees that work for CFEC. There's 5 attorneys that work for CFEC. There's numerous retirees that it mentions are coming in, getting paid very generously, and apparently are coming and going as they please with no one tracking their accountability. There's no job descriptions at CFEC, and the CFEC's process 3 permits in each of the last 2 years, and which is a record low. And the processing of permits is sort of maybe a function of there's just not a whole lot of permits to process. But the backlog is troubling also, because you mentioned there's 28 cases where there's a backlog, but those 28 cases are nearly all 15 years old or older. So these aren't new cases. In fact, the Alaska Supreme Court issued a scathing opinion back in 2006 on the length of time that it took cases for and how long cases were being delayed. So, in fact, here's what they said. The court stated that CFEC's handling of this one particular case in 2006 was inexcusable in that the delay was unconscionable. The court admonished CFEC for proceeding at a, quote, glacial pace and stated that CFEC's reasons for the delay were, quote, wholly unpersuasive. So something's happening there. Changes need to happen. And I'm not seeing there's a bill in the House to change. I don't know what the right answer is. I think there's probably some good merit to keeping it independent. But I think changes need to happen sooner rather than later. Do you agree with that or disagree with that?
I would just add, Senator Wilkowski, with global warming, presumed glacial pace might be pretty fast. But please proceed.
Well, certainly through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I do agree with that. Not necessarily the Lawson report, if that's what you're alluding to. And the interesting thing I found about that, it was one of the first things I encountered when I came in. In fact, on my very first day, I had breakfast with the other two commissioners and walked right into an audit, dead cold. So I didn't know exactly what I was getting myself in for. But after reviewing the 71, 72 pages of the Lawson report, one thing dawned on me. There was no basis or nexus where that report actually articulated the reasons, the legislative and the legal reasons why CFEC was set up the way it was. And I would think if I were doing a review of an agency or a department, I'd start out as, why are they there and what was their function? What was the locus and focus? And then I would have built out my review of those folks from that point. Now, you talk about the one case, and I have gone through that, where they cited Dickens's, the case was called Jaundice v. Jaundice, which was just a play on words for jaundice. It was yellow with age. And there's nothing worse than trying to revisit a case that, you know, you might have had people that testified that are dead. You have yellowing pages of documents, and it's tough. So, I mean, those are good questions, and they certainly need to be addressed. And I think there's a commitment at this point amongst the three commissioners down there as we're trying to reorganize, as we're putting it together. Like I said, I just got there, and, you know, maybe perhaps I come in with a fresh way of looking management-wise. You know, how can we make this better? How can we make it function better? And how can we streamline our process but not lose sight of the mission that we have to accomplish? But certainly I have to agree with what, you know, the original founders of CFEC did when they made it an independent agency, because then it is unbiased, because it is dealing with who, in fact, is going to be using the commercial and financially for economic benefit of the natural resource that's defined as to sustain it for the maximum benefit of all Alaska. But there's never been a definition of the term maximum benefit. So you've got this tension. And people who have worked in the law and in management understand that you've got to keep that balance and you don't want to raise a conflict of interest. But I certainly do believe, since I've been there, that, you know, we need to start realigning how we do things and maybe streamlining things to bring it in line with a budgetary issue we have today, what's going on in Alaska and, you know, with the geo-oil politics. You know, we're at the mercy of everybody at this point, and that's an unfortunate thing for the state of Alaska. But I'll do the best I can with the other two commissioners on board, providing I'm there and Commissioner Brown is, to start pulling it together, because we started working on a reorganization plan since I've been there.
Do you think it would be fair this year for us, for the legislature, to make cuts to the CFEC, whether they be unallocated cuts, 10%, 20% or more, or sort of go in and pick off? I know, again, there's a bill on it, but I think there's potentially $1 million, $2 million worth of savings that we should be able to find out of this commission.
Well, we've already, from my understanding, we've lost three PCNs, and the agency started out at 41 or 42 people. It's down to 28, from my understanding. And it has been for a very long time. And it only spends about 90% of its budget. Three PCNs have already been cut out of the budget. And so there's savings in that. But I have stated, and I think to its credit, it brings in more revenue than it spends and actually creates a surplus revenue in the state. And I'm trying to figure out who else does that.
Who does that?
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting when you can make government a business that pays. And, you know, is there a need to realign ourselves and maybe modify and go look for some more cuts? Perhaps. you know, and, but we need to really examine that budget so we don't lose sight of the mission, you know, and it's a service to the commercial fishing industry, because nothing's worse for commercial fishermen to find themselves being caught in a tail dragger and they can't get their gear in the water. And from what I see, that the licensing, if they deny it, there's still interim permits allowed or emergency permits amongst families so they can keep that gear in the water and actually make the living they need to make, especially in these coastal villages.
Yeah. Division of Motor Vehicles does a pretty good job of surplus revenue. But, any other questions? Once you step aside, we'll take Mr. Brown's testimony, which I assume will be a little shorter, and then we'll, if there's any public testimony, and then we'll move on to the next appointees. We'll go from fish to fish to fish with Mark.
Good morning, members of the Senate State Affairs Committee, Mr. Chairman, and other senators. My pleasure to be here. My name is Benjamin Brown, and I've been reappointed to a second four-year term on the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission. Brevity being my goal here, several of you were able to hear me kind of give a synopsis of my life, how I got to this job in the prior committee of referral, the Senate Resources Committee. So, but basically, I'm a lifelong Alaskan. I was born in Anchorage. I grew up in Palmer, went outside, came back after I got a degree in D.C., worked in this building as a legislative aide for many years, went back outside to law school, came back once again, moved to Juneau after I passed the bar up in Anchorage, worked in the courthouse across the street clerking for Judge Weeks. And have done a number of other different things in the past 15 years since I passed the bar, including being a legislative liaison for DEC and being a lobbyist for the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce. I was in private practice for a number of years, most recently with Baxter, Roofs & Sullivan, which is a long-established firm here in Juneau. And for the past 4 years, I've had the pleasure of serving on the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission. For two of those years, there have only been two commissioners, the chairman, Bruce Tromley, and myself. And Commissioner Ruprecht has joined us, as he just spoke to you about a couple of months ago, at a very challenging time for the agency. But, you know, we're just a microcosm of state government. I don't think that we're... Our challenges may be different than those that are facing all other state agencies and all of you as legislators who have to make very difficult policy decisions in these very straitened fiscal times. And so we certainly don't seek to avoid scrutiny. And Senator Wilkowski, you were Mr. Chairman, but he was able to ask me some pointed questions in the last committee of Senate Resources. And, you know, that's a dialogue I'm happy to continue having. I've attempted to try to meet with anyone individually who would like to discuss the Lawson Report, our response to the Lawson Report, House Bill 112, which does seek to abolish the agency and annex all of its functions to Fish and Game. And I think one thing that didn't get mentioned, well, I guess Commissioner Ruprecht mentioned it in passing, because he did literally go to a meeting with Legislative Audit before he even was able to visit his new office when he started his term of service. And that audit is underway, and there have been two and then three auditors working full-time out in a little a room in our offices out at the Jordan Creek Center. I heard in House Finance the other day there was a number cited by Ms. Curtis, the legislative auditor, of $67 an hour. I don't know how many hours these three people have put in, but it's a lot. I mean, it's been what they've been doing for the past month, and so I think it would be very premature to make any of the policy decisions that Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, mentioned until that audit comes out. You know, I think that's going to be the most objective, comprehensive look at what our agency does, and it's going to have a roadmap to some things that we might do differently. And I think it's going to be much more objective than the Lawson Report, no disrespect to Mr. Lawson, but that wasn't an audit, and we didn't have a chance to respond to it before it was released. And it's kind of like hearsay. It's an out-of-court statement introduced to in support of the assertions therein. He's not been, you know, cross-examined.
The Department of Fish and Game is engaging in hearsay and rhetoric against the CFEC. That one baffles me, Mr. Brown.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I can't lay it at the entire Department of Fish and Game, and I certainly, there's a new commissioner there, you know, so he came on board similarly to Commissioner Ruprecht and kind of stepped into the river, if you will, of, as it was flowing forward. We will get
that was
it.
An assertion of how independent you are there.
Well, at any rate, so, you know, we will respond to all the criticisms that come our way to the best of our ability, but I think the bottom line is there is a reason we were created as an independent agency, and there's a reason we should continue to be independent, and that can be done in a myriad of ways that are as cost-effective as possible and provide the best level of service to all Alaskans, and indeed non-Alaskans who are fortunate enough to have fishing privileges in Alaska. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Is this audit supposed to be done before April 20th?
No, unfortunately, they had set themselves an accelerated timeline. Representative Seaton, who some of you may know was the sponsor of the legislation to abolish CFEC last session, requested the audit in August after the Parnell administration had initiated the internal, so-called internal review that became the Lawson Report. And Ledge Audit's a busy organization. They've got a lot going on. So they've really tried to speed the plow, but there's no way, I think, on this lovely earth, but that's going to be done before the end.
Maybe a subcommittee headed by C. Seaton could manage this like he does some of the other things.
I couldn't opine on the wisdom or the legality or the possibilities there, Mr. Chairman.
And I was opining probably very recklessly and carelessly, and I'll withdraw that.
I would never suggest that.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, through the chair. Welcome to the committee. Mr. Brown, I trust your judgment. I have worked with you for many, many years. You know, I don't know why you didn't become a doctor like your parents, but you became a lawyer, and you're a good one. And I like the way that you think through things and rationalize. So I'm going to ask you a question just to kind of step up to 35,000 feet and tell me, as a state senator, what is the value of this commission, and why is it important to Alaskans? And if it is, how can you use your wisdom to help reorganize it? And what would it look like if you got done putting your best efforts into reorganizing it and making it that best commission to serve Alaskans? And what would the functions be?
Mr. Chairman, Senator McGuire.
We'll see how independent he is here.
Well, your first question, what's the value of the agency to Alaskans? The value is that it is an independent agency. The three commissioners are appointed by the governor, have to be confirmed by the legislature, and then can only be removed for cause. And so they are not beholden to their appointing authority the way it's currently structured. And so every decision that's been made in the four decades the agency's been in existence has been made with that independence and autonomy. And as a result, the decisions about who received a permit and, as a corollary, who did not receive a permit have a great deal of integrity behind them. Permits are transferable, and that was something that was a policy call that was made by the legislature when the Limited Entry Act was first passed. But in the Ostrowski case, that decision was challenged, and the Supreme Court said, no, transferability is a good idea. And as a result, some permits are worth $500,000 now. And the renewal fees are set by a statutory and regulatory formula.
Like liquor licenses. There's a secondary market.
Yeah, exactly. There's a very great value to those permits. And I believe that the value of those permits, the reason people are willing to pay so much money for them and consider them valuable assets that they can sell to somebody else or give to their children or grandchildren, is because of the integrity of the way in which they were initially issued, and that the independent commission also plays a very regular oversight role in the transfer of those permits on a permanent basis or on an emergency basis. And if that independence and autonomy were somehow compromised, I think in the long term it would undermine the belief in the value of those permits. And there are only two entities, CFAB, the Commercial Fishing and Agriculture Bank, and the Division of Economic Development's Commercial Revolving Loan Fund, that are able to use permits for collateral. I think that the collateralization of loans with those permits would be undermined by the loss of the autonomy. And if it were seen as just another decision being made at the monolithic Department of Fish and Game and not an independent agency, I think that would be a real loss to Alaskans. So to turn to, Mr. Chairman, the second part of your question, Senator McGuire, how can we reorganize? We've already done some things since I had the pleasure of appearing before a committee in this room a month ago. We have a new website that's already up. It looks much more like other state websites in terms of the access and scroll over and pull down features. That's something that had been in the work. We didn't just crank that out. I'm not claiming that in the past 4 weeks, but that's something that had been in the work. There are many other technological improvements that I would like to see implemented. And frankly, you know, 4 years is a while, and I certainly will answer for everything that's happened in the 4 years I've been there and some of the things that happened before, but there hasn't been as much change as there could have been in the past 4 years. I have no illusions that the next 4 years, if there is a next 4 years, will be as static as that. I definitely think that we are going to see a much more dynamic process of self-analysis and self-improvement at CFEC. So by way of example, right now when someone renews his or her permit online, it's a little clunky, and our friends from the United Fishermen of Alaska, I see a representative of the organization in the room, have been very pointed about why it's not the kind of service they would like. Okay. But there's a problem. We can't make it like My Alaska, like you're applying for a dividend, because not all of our permit holders are Alaskans. And we're not going to give My Alaska accounts to people who live in Oregon and Washington. So we need to find a way to have that same online functionality. So when you, like when you go in to file your POFD, we all, I assume, just filed our POFDs and aren't going to get a fine from APOC because those were due last Sunday the 15th. Yeah. That's a pretty easy process now, and it wasn't 5 years ago. You know, I mean, it's a lot easier to fill that format online than it was 5 years ago. I would like to see us continue to take some strides towards providing technologically up-to-date service online to our constituents, and I think that may result in some potential downsizing and personnel costs because technology is serving to meet some of those needs. That's just one example. But Commissioner Ruprecht was not exaggerating when he said that the three of us have been spending a lot of time talking about things we might change, ways we might reorganize. We are an exempt agency, and so we don't have to go through cumbersome, lengthy processes to reclassify positions. And the three PCNs that were eliminated, we will be able to, so that's $284,000 that's gone from the budget. I have no reason to believe the Senate Finance Subcommittee is going to put that money back in, but we won't know until the closeout a week from today, next Thursday the 26th. But at any rate, whatever resources we have, I think if we can increase the amount that we are generating excess of our operating costs, that will be to the benefit of the legislature and the state, because that will be more revenue that can be used for other beneficial purposes that relate to our agency's mission. So, but we are thinking about it. Some of it's going to be personnel stuff, so I'm not going to get too detailed about that. But we are trying to look at the big picture, how we do what we do, and how we can do it as well as possible.
I have a question for you on the permits. Somebody buys a permit. What do they actually get? Do the people still own the inventory?
Well, they take over that fishing privilege, so they're able to go out and use that permit card in the new owner's name to land fish and make money.
Do you believe that when that person buys that permit, that also, instead of just buying them access at the discretion of the department, do you believe it gives them an entitlement and a preference for the use of that fish? Or do the people of Alaska still own the inventory?
I understand your question now more clearly, Mr. Chairman.
The inventory, that means the commonly owned fisheries resources of Alaska.
In Title 16 in the Limited Entry Act, the legislature was very clear at its inception to say that it's a revocable use privilege that can be taken back by the legislature with no compensation. So,
during Finance Committee last year, Mr. Twomley asserted that it was a constitutional right. I think it's a constitutional allowance, is Article 8, and the amendment passed in 70 or 72. Do you share that the corrected view?
It is not quota. It is not quota like federal quota by any stretch of the imagination.
Some people do presume it is the way they.
I would never want to perpetuate that misperception, because again, the statute's very clear that it's a revocable privilege that the legislature could take away, and it says without compensation right there in the statute. So anyone who thinks that isn't the fact needs to read the statute. And I would agree, Mr. Chairman, with your assessment. Ultimately, the Constitution, the baseline rule is that we own all of our resources in common. This is an exception to that rule that was put in by the voters to elect.
Much like that refrain, it's our oil, it's our fish.
It's both our oil and our fish, Mr. Chairman.
It's like an easement, almost, yeah.
And we'll spend just two or three more minutes. I imagine the person most excited by this level of question is Mark Lucan, because there's also... But Senator Wilkowski.
We're just warming up for Commissioner Lucan. Ben, good to see you again. Great job last night, by the way. Is there any plans, or do you believe we need to limit any fisheries or develop any optimum numbers of permits for the limited fisheries that we have now?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wilkowski, there are several fisheries that could be limited in the next few years. And we don't like to talk about that in great detail, because when a fishery is on the brink of potential limitation, when fishermen who have not been participating are aware of that, they do what is sometimes called fishing for history. And they'll go out and make sure that they deploy their gear so that they are one of the units of gear who fished in the four-year window looking prior to the limitation date. And we don't want to encourage that sort of fishing for history behavior. You want to see people who have actually been fishing be rewarded with a permit when limitation goes forward. So, but yes, there are some fisheries where fishermen in Alaska, and they have been mostly Alaskans and not non-Alaskans, have come to us in my 4 years on the commission and have said, we think, for whatever reason, and it's different fishery to fishery, it's species to species and geographical area to geographical area. So yes, I would not be surprised if in the next 4 years we actually did go forward with a limitation of one, two, possibly three fisheries. As far as optimum numbers go, I would say, Mr. Chairman, Senator Wilkowski, that we have been a little remiss in fulfilling our duties under the statute to perform optimum number studies. And I'm not trying to make excuses for that. They are complex, cumbersome things. To do a full-blown optimum number study, you need to look at net earnings, not just gross earnings. And that requires getting exemplary tax information, what I made and what I spent to make it, from several fishermen in the fishery to be able to say, well, this person's not getting a decent economic return. And so as you can well imagine, that's a pretty intrusive process. Chairman Twomley was able to do sort of an informal optimum number. It wasn't a study, but it was an informal optimum number statement, which was upheld by the Supreme Court for Northern Southeast Sablefish. And I think we need to look at ways to prioritize all the limited fisheries, figure out which ones are most in need of some sort of optimum number statement, try to generate that statement without doing the full-blown optimum number study, and then for those that actually require the full-blown optimum number study, allocate the resources to do that. Right now, we have a three-person research section, and there's a fourth person, a position that's vacant, and we had gone through recruitment right at the end of last year, and we've not filled that position, but that's one of the ones where we're going to, it's going to be, you know, when we're moving things around, we're going to need to make sure that the resources are there for those optimum number determinations going forward, because they require people who have good research skills, who understand the biological nature of fisheries, who are also good economists, and who can really manage computer data systems really well. So, but yes, there is optimum number and potential limitation work before us in the next 4 years that I think double back around is one of the reasons why we need to remain independent, so that we are sure of the validity and independence of those determinations when we issue them.
Senator Huggins, one last question.
Thank you, and thank you, Mr. Brown. I've always been an admirer of yours. If you could just describe for us, and believe me, what I'm asking you, I don't know the answer to this instant question, but I think it's important that we all have an appreciation for it. So in your experience, you've been on the board how long?
4 years, Mr.
4 years. Okay, so you've kind of been through the process. What are the, in the decision process, what are the, let's call it the top four decision processes that it comes to the commission and that are different but fulfills your role as a commission? The top four.
Well, the different kinds of decisions we issue, I think, is, if I understand your question, Mr. Chairman, Senator Huggins.
And this is lightning round.
Okay, well, the most important one is the issuance of an original permit. And those are the 28 cases that have been around longer than they should have been around that we have committed to cleaning up.
And number two?
And so those are the most weighty ones. And so the first one of those that I did when I came on board, Commissioner Tromley had recused himself from, and so I wrote a 20-page opinion based on a box of documents, two transcripts, you know, of hearings that took place 15 years ago and 8 years ago. And we sent that back out, and it was appealed to Superior Court, and there was remand.
Number two
is our transfers, and we have to oversee a permanent transfer. So if you want to sell your permit to someone else, we need to see the paperwork, make sure that there's nothing, pardon the pun, fishy about the deal, and then we sign off on it so you can get paid, the new person can get the permit and go out fishing. And then emergency transfers are the third category of decision that we review. Those are very time sensitive because there has to be an emergency. You can't just lease your permit. You can't just decide, I want to sit home and, you know, watch soap operas this summer. I'm going to just get some money and let somebody else go out fish on this. But if you have a verifiable medical emergency, or your spouse or your child does, then we will consider that and probably grant you an emergency transfer so that you can have someone use the permit, you can get some money. And then the fourth one are miscellaneous decisions, the assessment of demerit points in salmon fisheries for people who break the law and are fishing in closed waters. We have to make sure that a court's assessment, that we assess demerit points against their permits that can prevent them from fishing for a period of time or ultimately even revoke the permit. And there are other categories of miscellaneous decisions. But those are the four things that we do that come before commissioners that we have to sign off on and make sure has been done correctly by staff.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. We're going to have some public testimony. We have Mr. Lundy.
All right. Thank you very much, members of the committee, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks, Brad.
Welcome, Mr. Lundy.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman Stoltz and members of the committee. I appreciate you taking the time to listen to those from the commercial fishing sector and the voice on the and our voice on the governor's appointments to positions which decide and determine the livelihoods of thousands and are paid for by commercial fishing fees and licenses. My name is Martin Lundy, and I am here on behalf of the Southeast Alaska Saners Association, a commercial fishing gear group with offices just across the street in the Alaska Fishermen's Building, with over 150 paying skipper and crew memberships, as well as over 75 paying business members. SEAS represents the interests of roughly 1,500 fishermen in the SO1A fishery and their families and communities throughout Southeast Alaska and beyond. The Southeast Alaska Saners Association wholeheartedly implores you to support the reappointment of Commissioner Ben Brown and appointment of Commissioner Vern Ruprecht to the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission. Both of these individuals bring with them the particular experience, perspective, and job know-how that enables them to conserve the fishery and serve the commercial fishing men and women of this state in the best way possible. Both Commissioner Brown and Commissioner Ruprecht have backgrounds in law, but much more than that, they have practical legal experience And having been on the other side in the real world of maritime and fisheries law, they bring that proficiency and wisdom to the table when helping decide individual cases, each one unique, that affect occupations, businesses, families, and indeed whole communities. We take a dim view of the way in which CFEC has been portrayed in some corners, especially by those with personal vendettas, and we want to encourage you to keep politics out of any decisions regarding these appointments and hear the most important voice for whom this decision directly affects, the commercial fishing men and women of Alaska. CEES is uniquely positioned to comment and evaluate CFEC's job performance. Unlike some who have used a snapshot in time to render judgment on an entire department's workings, the Southeast Alaska Saners Association worked for years with commissioners and public servants of CFEC during the buyback of permits in the SO1A fishery. This nearly decade-long process involving multiple parties was and continues to be the only buyback program of its kind, not simply in this state or in this nation, but in the world. And CFEC handled it all just as it had to be done, in an exhaustive and exemplary manner. Commissioners Brown and Ruprecht carry on the great work of past commissioners such as Frank Homan and Mary McDowell, Peter Freilich, and with buybacks in various fisheries in Cook Inlet or Bristol Bay or Southeast on the horizon, the state needs their competence and expertise. Simply put, Commissioners Brown and Ruprecht are very good at what they do. And as a representative of the skippers and crew members who fund the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission and pay their salaries with boat fees and licenses, we couldn't think of better individuals to do this job. We encourage you to confirm both Commissioner Brown and Ruprecht and do all that you can to help keep CFEC competent and independent. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Is it Dr. Lundy now?
It is, yes. But it's the useless kind of doctor.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony. And we have, is that in written form so we can?
No,
we'll make sure after the meeting give it to Mr. George and we'll put it on the basis so sees as a part of the, everybody sees this as part of the record. Anybody else here in the room wishing to testify? We have a letter from United Fishermen to Governor Walker that delivered to us. They support Mr. Brown, and if they wish to elaborate, they can jump forward. Anybody online? On our teleconference network. We have one person. One person identify themselves. They may be muted. Oh, wait a second. We'll come back to that if there is anybody. But, I know there's some people will often have to go do something else. I understand that. We will. Are there any questions of the two commissioners before us for the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission? We will. We'll hold that. We'll make motions at the end of the meeting.
Okay.
Thank you, gentlemen. We have next Mr. Fish online. Continuing our topic of fish. If I haven't worn that one out.
Thank you, guys.
I hear a little bit of noise on the line. Mr. Fish, are you online?
Yes, can you hear me?
We can now. Go ahead and, you know the procedure. I know you've been before the legislature in the past.
Thank you. Through the chair, senators, for the record, my name is Mark Fish, and I'm here representing myself. There are a few things I would like to address. First, the information I submitted online to the Boards and Commission contains an error under conflict of interest. I or any member of my family is not affected financially by the decisions made by APOC. I've come to believe that there's an issue with the web interface and that the field for this question somehow misreported my answer to this question as a yes instead of a no. Secondly, I did not request, solicit, or campaign for this appointment. I was asked to serve. And in my opinion, a commission appointment, particularly one to a semi-judicial body, is much like jury duty. When called upon, if there's no compelling reason not to serve, I feel it's a civic duty and a personal responsibility to answer that call. my interest has always been a free and fair society, and certainly I could pursue those interests as part of APOC. And lastly, I would like to note my resume has been submitted, so for the sake of brevity, I will highlight a few of the qualifications I feel noteworthy. The staff at the Human Rights Commission maintains an impeccable minutes. If you're so inclined, I encourage you to review my years of service with the Alaska State Commission of Human Rights. I think you will find I maintain my commission with integrity and honor worthy of the position. I would also like to note my years of service on the Citizens Advisory Commission of Federal Areas. For the last two terms, my fellow CAFCA commissioners have expressed faith and confidence in my abilities by electing me vice chair. I'm willing to serve on the APOC commission, and I feel I am qualified. With that said, I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Fish. I'll just ask a general question about your philosophy. What's the role of the commission? Is it... I know it is a legal entity, but what's your philosophy about the role of regulating campaigns, the role of government, how it interfaces the Supreme Court's decisions on free speech, the whole line? I think this is just your general philosophy. If you could comment on that.
Sure, Senator. I guess my general philosophy is one of a libertarian, which is basically in support of a limited government. One of those core functions of government is the public process of accountability for elected officials. I view that as a preservation of rights, not only for those who decide to run and speak freely in the public square, but also to protect the rights of those that are listening, and ensuring that there's a transparency and the information to make a valid choice is available to them. So, in essence, I believe that the APOC Commission is there to, in fact, ensure that there is transparency. I don't think we're there to set limits on political speech, and I think we're there mostly to make sure that that speech is available to everybody that needs to know it to get their rational decisions when it comes time to vote.
Thank you. Senator McGuire has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Fish, and thank you for... I would agree with your assessment that being tapped to serve on the Alaska Public Offices Commission is akin to jury duty. I can't believe anybody would do it, and I appreciate the fact that you're willing to, so thank you for your willingness to serve. My assessment of what's happened on the APOC board, just a little background, not that you know me, but 15 years I've served, and I've been either chair of judiciary or on judiciary all those 15 years, so I've interfaced with all of the APOC commissioners and their hearings, their oversight hearings, and then, of course, the executive directors. And so back when I was in the House, we had a director named Brooke Miles, and Brooke's philosophy was one of active engagement with the legislature. She believed firmly that lawmakers were good people, they were dedicated to public service, and so she took a very active approach, and so did the commissioners, of engaging with lawmakers, trying to teach us what the new rules were, those kinds of things, and that was the philosophy, and so you had very few, I would say, APOC violations. She'd work with you, and people would come out and again be transparent and report. And then about 5 years ago, roughly, the tone changed, and the APOC director changed, and the commission changed, and they began a process, unbeknownst to us, of what they call auto reporting, where instead of a citizen having to bring a complaint, they could internally decide you have a violation. And this happened to me, my first ever allegation of anything, and it was over me giving leftover funds to the Traumatic Brain Injury Association and Special Olympics in Alaska. And $5,000 later in legal fees, I won the challenge, but it was awful to go through. And it was not a challenge, obviously, by a citizen. It was a challenge by the APOC board. And I just ask you what your thoughts are about this auto sort of, it's an audit process, I guess you will, and what you think about it, and then generally what your philosophy is about interfacing with the legislature.
Sure, through the chair, Senator McGuire. I do believe in active engagement with all the parties that are dealing with these regulations. One of the things that I experienced in my dealings with APOC as a candidate, as a chairman of the Libertarian Party, and as a citizen, is and getting questions answered and trying to follow the regulations is not always easy. And if a person makes an honest effort for that, I think it's the commission's job to ensure that they have that information. Certainly, I would like to see some more emphasis on an availability of training courses so that anybody running for public office or campaigning for an issue has the information available in a timely manner so they can comply with the law. The other one is the information that they report. This reporting should be as easy and fluid as possible, which I think technology can be used, and it's starting to be used to leverage that to make that happen. I don't think it's the role of the commission to act as a sort of a star chamber and go out and look for violations. And it comes to the point of looking like it's punitive and can be used as a weapon instead of the tool that it was designed to use. I think that we ought to encourage citizens, encourage the press, and everybody to use the information that's recorded so they can make those determinations on what to go after. And again, I'd like to emphasize that our statutes should be enforced, but the regulations have to be clear, and the citizens themselves are the one, ultimately the wielders of the political power, and they should be the ones that bring this stuff forward.
I really appreciate your remarks, and I just want to clarify, because I intend to put this into a bill working with Representative Hawker and the other body. It was basically an area where the law was sort of silent. It said, you can give to nonprofits at the end of the cycle, but in the interim it was silent. But the other part of it that I forgot to mention, as you mentioned on the star chamber part, was that because this violation was made, or the allegation and the violation was made by APOC itself, I had a political opponent, and they made public a letter that said you could be fined up to $20,000. I'd never had an APOC violation in my life, and so he went public with it all over the radio, and I had neighbors who said to me, my God, I mean, they called and said, this sounds really serious, Lisa. I mean, really, you've never had an APOC violation, and if it's up to $20,000, that could be terrible. So there's also some things I'd love to talk to you further. I think your confirmation is assured, but that I want to deal with the ethics committee. In the legislature, they don't allow their committee to be used as a political weapon, and you used the term star chamber. I liked it, but I think we need to think a little bit too about how complaints are made and how they're used, and the idea of keeping them quiet until they're resolved, because of course ultimately I was vindicated, but that tool was used and ultimately it wasn't resolved until after the election. So arguably there are people who may have voted against me because they believed it to be possibly true. So anyway, thank you for your comments.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Fish, Charlie Huggins here, Meadow Lakes. You know, I've read several different versions of why APOC has certain complexions of people. And then I hear your testimony, and you talk about being an independent, which, you know, quite frankly, I haven't heard much of what party people are from in testimony generally in the legislature. But that's okay, because that kind of gets to my question to you. Can you explain how you as an independent are talking about being an independent and why you're on APOC and not somebody else?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, sure. I characterize myself as a libertarian. I am a member.
Right, libertarian. My mistake.
And that is why I'm before you here today. How the statute reads is the top two vote getters in the governor's election gets appointments to APOC. So the Libertarian Party gets to select two, and I made it through this process so far, somewhat convoluted, but it comes to be that I'm their choice and the governor's choice to be in front of you today because of it. One thing that I stated in my hearing through the House State Affairs Committee is that I feel that the public would be better served if this was not this appointment was not hand selected by any political party. I do think eventually we need to get to a point where it is closer to jury duty, where party affiliation is not considered, or parties don't get a bite at the apple in selecting this. I think it should be up to the governor, and obviously the confirmation process through the legislature. But I wouldn't give, if I had my preference, I wouldn't give political parties the right to dictate who sits on this commission.
Yeah, that sort of makes sense to me, Mr. Chairman. And I'm just trying to make sure that I've got a good feel for, the process. So you and APOC also have oversight of nonpartisan races and candidates. Is that accurate?
Yes. Through the chair, Senator Huggins, APOC does have oversight, I believe, for all state and local elections within Alaska's borders.
Yeah, and that's, to me, was kind of the strangest part, because there has to be a certain complexion of the person like yourself and party affiliation, but yet you deal with people that are not supposed to use their identity, their political identity, for lack of a better term. But I guess there are stranger things in our system. Thank you very much, and good luck to you in your nomination.
Thank you, Senator.
Are there any other questions for Mr. Fish? Well, I appreciate your service. I voted for you when you were a human rights commissioner, and I've had the opportunity to work with you on some common causes in the past, and I think you're a good appointee and look forward to endorsing your nomination formally down the line, Mr. Fish, so thank you. Goodbye.
Godspeed.
Very good. Commissioner Lucan. Tell us what you know about fish.
Well, Mr. Chairman, before I start, in the interest of time, I might suggest that the committee continue on the subject of fish, and my portion of the hearing will be very brief.
Welcome.
Good morning, Chairman Stoltz and distinguished committee members. It is a genuine privilege to appear before you today, having the opportunity again to serve as the Commissioner of the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. It's a great and humbling honor. My primary focus as Commissioner will be to progress the department to meet the budget challenges that Alaska and DOT and PF currently face, yet also accomplish our core mission of keeping Alaskans moving. I intend to seek this balance by pursuing organizational consolidations and process improvements wherever possible across the department. We are already at work and considering options to centralize some key functions, while also standardizing the processes and tools we leverage daily to get our job done. As we consider change, be assured any change we propose must also be sustainable in terms of the department's core responsibilities and in light of the long-term health of our state's budget. As we transform, we will strive to minimize the impacts to our core services, which are so vital to Alaskans every day. Regarding our FY16 operating budget at this point in the legislative process, the reductions being proposed for DOT and PF's operating budget are significant. I commend the work our dedicated staff members have done to absorb and spread this reduction across the entire department so that the impacts are fair and equitable and not one service is affected significantly more than another. The department is also exploring new revenue generating opportunities. The time has come for this challenging conversation and we'll need your help going forward as we look to users to help defray the costs of our vast transportation infrastructure and state provided services. A couple of examples are a 4.5% increase in fares in the Marine Highway system, which will begin this May. The department is also introducing the concept of landing fees at the Dead Horse Airport in FY16. By 2017, it is estimated that these landing fees will help offset airport system costs and support, for the long term, one of the most important transportation hubs for the North Slope. Proactive steps like these, those that increase the department's revenue via its primary users, help protect the core services that are provided to Alaskans every day, and in turn, create a more sustainable operating budget approach going forward. During this period of fiscal uncertainty, especially where stakeholders may either experience a change in the DOT and PF provided service they're used to, or where they may see an increase in their out-of-pocket costs, it is ever more important to foster proactive and effective communications with these stakeholders. This includes the way improving upon the way I and my staff communicate with you, the legislature, enhancing how the department involves and communicates with the public, and cultivating better communication between department staff across the state. Improving communications doesn't only mean that we must be better at explaining what we can or cannot do, but that we must also be skilled, active listeners. Stakeholders such as yourselves and the public provide an immeasurable wealth of knowledge and experience that benefits any discussion with our department. Every citizen is indeed a subject matter expert, and so much more can be gained by placing greater emphasis upon the way DOT and PF involves Alaskans in the decision-making process. We must engage the public, understand and dignify positions, and conduct our work in a customer, client-focused manner. We are servants, and good servants are good listeners. I began my tenure as commissioner by bringing back a couple of familiar faces to the organizational leadership team. I saw a need for proven leaders to fill these positions in the organization, which is why I'm pleased to have Steve Hatter, our deputy commissioner, rejoined the department. Steve is an incredibly talented leader, project management expert, and organizational improvement enthusiast. During his previous tenure as department deputy commissioner, he made outstanding progress for the department in the aviation arena. I've also asked Deputy Commissioner Mike Musil to rejoin my leadership team as the deputy commissioner for the Alaska Marine Highway System. Mike also brings over 30 years of Marine and leadership experience to the mix as a former Coast Guard captain, with 12 of those years stationed right here in Alaska. Deputy Commissioner John Bender will continue to oversee the international airport system and statewide aviation for the department. These men exemplify our department core values of integrity, excellence, and respect, and they do not hesitate to challenge me. I trust you will find us a servant leader team who relentlessly are dedicated to getting it right versus being right. In light of the focus I just offered, the team and I have in place, my priority is to the organization. My vision as commissioner will focus on the department's core mission and functions, mobility, access, and commerce. As a department, we must continue to provide safe, environmentally responsible, and sustainable mobility for travelers, improve access and opportunity for Alaskans and business, and support commerce so that Alaska can grow economically. As I've said, we know we have to meet these needs with fewer resources, and the hard transformational work to achieve that end is underway. My second priority will be focused on our culture. The DOT and PF must continue the admirable work accomplished under the previous leadership team to become one department, a department that functions as one DOT instead of in separate silos of geographic location and service that have evolved over time. The AMHS, roads, and aviation all complement each other to keep Alaskans moving. As we drive to become one, we must tenaciously hold to our core values of integrity, excellence, and respect. The DOTF, you and the public should experience as one operating transparently, honestly, and responsibly. This is the embodiment of integrity and respect. You can trust DOT and PF because we daily earn your trust. These performance measures will be public. Under the core value of excellence, we will strive for continuous improvement, operating in learning mode and measuring our performance regularly. These performance measures will be published to show Alaskans where their money is being spent. Our service will reflect an attitude of responsibility and servitude to the public, rather than authority over the public. Finally, we must also become efficient in our most important resource, our people. We stand to lose up to 30% of our workforce in the next 5 years, primarily due to the age of our workforce. Many are reaching retirement age in the next 5 years. Therefore, I desire to create an organization that people want to be part of, one that encourages growth and recognizes and rewards collaboration and innovation. As I mentioned previously, but I want to emphasize again, we will strive to build an organization that is accountable to you and to Alaskans, which promotes integrity, excellence, and respect. One of my greatest encouragements as I've learned more about the department is the quality of the people that make up DOT and PF. We already have an incredibly dedicated and professional workforce, and I'm privileged to serve them in this capacity. My goal is to give them the executive guidance, the resources, and the training, and the focus to be better than ever. Governor Walker has said the fiscal challenges before us present an opportunity to reset and reevaluate the proper and effective role for state government. I look forward to taking on this challenge so that we may better serve Alaskans today and tomorrow. Thank you. I'm available for questions.
Thank you, Commissioner Lucan. Appreciate that. Not many public officials get a second act, and you're returning here and scouring the memory, and all five of us here, I think, voted for your confirmation originally, and I think you were confirmed by a 58-1 vote, and you're probably plagued by quite of that one person. And I know I it's a natural reaction. I always wondered, Mike, talk about your second act, and then so I can go to the next question afterwards. Question I have is the aviation community has always had a lot of concerns, and it's not about reorganizing the department, but just having a flow of information that gets to the commissioner's office, just taking that organizational arrow, just making sure that concerns don't dead end within a division or somewhere down in one of those organizational boxes, a couple steps below you, or even one step below you. That's probably not the most prominent, but other folks will ask you about highways and stuff. So those are the two questions, your second act and the aviation information flow, and so things get to you so you can make a decision one way or another.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, and if you heard my testimony, that is certainly one of the objectives of our leadership team is to build that communication, like I said, not just outside the organization, but within the organization. For that very reason, so that I, as the commissioner, and my deputy commissioners are aware of those issues and then can address them appropriately.
Second act. What's anything you're doing different this time, or is it what did you learn from round one and makes you a stronger candidate? I assume you wouldn't come back because you feel less qualified or more deficient. That you probably feel you. I'll let you answer that.
Okay, now I understand the question a little better. I think what I would say is that we started this process 3 years ago to try and bring the organization more toward a single entity, and that, as I stated in my remarks, that actually was carried on by the previous leadership team. There's still plenty of work to do. You know, to change a culture in an organization is a multi-year effort, and so we would like to continue that to bring this organization into a less siloed, less geographically separated organization, so that we're sharing ideas, but we're also sharing issues, and then that information gets flowed up toward the to the top when necessary.
I just had one last question. A previous commissioner, who I liked exceedingly well, I tried to pass along a criticism and concern. I said, your department is like this big, old, antique anvil that laughs at a pile of broken hammers. I meant it as a criticism that the bureaucracy is so entrenched and strong. They took it as a compliment, and all of a sudden it was their department logo, and that way, I gotta be careful of those. Can you comment on the anvil? And I know you understand what I'm talking about.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, you're exactly right, and I think that is one of our big challenges, and it is a cultural issue, and so with the leadership team that I have in place, that is again the direction we're trying to move is to break down a lot of those habits to make it less bureaucratic, more open. As I said, certainly open to input from the public, from the legislature, and we are moving in a direction to really radically change the culture.
Senator Huggins, Wilkowski, and then McGuire.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and welcome back, Commissioner Lucan. Is Steve Hatter in the room?
The chair, Senator. Yes,
I thought I recognized him. I just comment in my limited experience, and I don't profess to know any of the aviation people personally, but my view of Steve Hatter, he's about as good as they come in that capacity. And Steve, I congratulate you. So, Mr. Commissioner, normally a person like you wouldn't know about highway safety corridors and the nuances of them. I'm going to ask you very simply. You know, I'm one of those guys that rides with the Roman Legion into Anchorage out of Wasilla, and I ride back with the Roman Legion, lots of cars. And sometimes on weekends, long holidays, those highway safety corridor maintenance areas, 55 miles an hour, slow down. There isn't anybody around. The road, you could drive 100 miles an hour on it if you wanted to sometime during the weekend, but you're bound to go back down to the 55. And most states have a provision when workers are present or you have your people take the signs down when they're not working there. What are you going to do? What can we expect? Is it good enough as it is?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, I think certainly the speed limits are set based on traffic data from the that we've gathered over the years. It's also based on best practices.
Highway safety corridor. I'm talking about highway safety corridors.
Yes, sir.
Right.
And so I think the mere fact that it is identified as a highway safety corridor recognizes that it is a high risk. Corridor or a high-risk area of traffic, and so as a result, that also helps define those speed limits.
Yeah. So you may be right. My observation may be incorrect. You know, it essentially goes from 65 to 55. I can tell you everybody's driving 65 or 70 because they recognize, as I do, that there's no reason to be going 55. Nobody's working, and the road is absolutely perfect. I won't belabor that point. projects. And you have a tough job, right? There's mega projects, ever how we want to characterize them, but I read, I think, an email today where there'd been a decision made on projects. Some were going to be retarded here in the last couple of days. That may be old information to you, but I saw an email that talked about the access road here in Juneau and maybe one or two others. My question is not the merit of those projects, because some have to fall by the wayside. I've become a bit disillusioned because of who's in the legislature and elections and re-elections, some of the priorities change on things. And then governor probably has the biggest impact on that. My question for you and the decision on these projects, can you just describe to us the process? Or do you make that decision? And if you make the decision, describe to me the process. You get guidance, or do you, you know, kind of work through and go back and get guidance so that people understand? Because I don't know how you came at that. And other people, I think it's, we talk about having transparent governments and out in the open, and maybe it's perfectly out in the open and I was sleeping, but help me out.
Yes, Chair, Senator Huggins. My understanding of the process is for any of these projects, it doesn't matter what, you know, how big, there is a requirement for an environmental assessment, you know, and they range from categorical exclusion for the smaller projects through an environmental assessment all the way to an environmental impact statement. Within that, you have to define what is the purpose and need for this particular project. And that's stated right at the very beginning of any environmental impact statement. From that, then, there's quite a bit of work, usually upwards of 5, maybe even 10 years of work that are done studying the project, the merits of the project, the potential drawbacks. But many man hours of work go into these project environmental impact statements to include a public process, where once the analysis has been done, then that analysis is put out in a draft with a preferred alternative, and from that then we take additional public process. There is public process throughout the data gathering portion as well. I think with the projects that you're talking about or maybe referring to, I know the governor has issued an administrative order, and really what I think the purpose of that order was so that he could be apprised of the merits of these projects and possibly the preferred alternatives. And so I see that as my role. I'm not the decision maker. I'm not the decision maker necessarily for any of these. It is based on a preferred alternative and then recommendation, and then the funding agency, in most cases that being the Federal Highways, is the one who is the decision maker on through what's called a record of decision.
Mr. Chairman, just follow up, and I'm not nitpicking. I just want to make sure that people understand how they get an answer about a project. So just to Juneau Access, which, you know, you can debate that. I supported it. But if the administrative order came out, all right, we saw that. I don't debate that. The governor has that authority. The question, has the status of that project changed in the last 3 weeks, 2 weeks?
Through the chair, Senator, no, it has not. But I anticipate receiving a directive from the governor to tell me to go forward to a record of decision in the next week or so.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Senator Wilkowski, McGuire, and then Coghill. We're going to try to probably wrap it up here. We do have citizens waiting. And it's my intent on the counterman to, we'll keep taking the public testimony. I understand some folks may have to leave.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm still smiling at the chair's analogy of the anvil and the hammer. I think I've sort of likened
Department of Transportation to the fourth branch of government in the past. But I'm glad to hear that you're committed to changing that, because I know in the past it's been extremely frustrating dealing with the department on some issues. And on other issues, you've been tremendously responsive, and I appreciate that you're committed to changing that. I've always been impressed by your background, not only to our state but also to our country. You have tremendous credentials, and I supported you when you were up for confirmation last time. But then, less than 2 years into your term, you resigned abruptly, and I'd like to hear why you did that.
I think there was a time when your effectiveness is at an end, and at that point it was time to move on. But I would just say I really would rather not focus on that, and much rather focus on the future and moving forward.
What's changed? If you were unable to be effective back in 2012, after less than 2 years, what makes you think you can be effective now?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I think probably the biggest change is who my boss is right now, and so I think I have a better opportunity, having been asked by him to come back, a better opportunity to be effective at this point.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, and I respect that question, Senator Wilkowski. These are, the hearings where there's a tendency to not breach those kind of awkward things, but it's important to know that you can work with lots of different people and through difficult times. But I also respect your point, having served our country in a lot of leadership positions, that you know when you can make a difference and you know when you can't, and I think that's what you're telling us. So first I want to say thank you for serving our country. I really appreciate it. This gentleman, too, all right, I try to thank him any time I can. I think it's the most important thing he's done, and I would say the same to you, so thank you. I have a few things. I'm just going to hit you really quickly because I know the chairman of this committee is trying to get to the countermand. He's got his constituent here who's phoned all the way, because these are things we can follow up on, but they're things that are I'm very passionate about. I, too, have had difficulties dealing with the Department of Transportation. It is an incredible department in that it touches every aspect of Alaskans' lives. And you do great things and have done great things, but we can do so many things better. So I want to touch on procurement. When I was over in the other body, I came up with a great idea, and I still think it is a great idea, but I was thwarted 100% by the powers that be at that time, so hard that I finally said, all right, let's just do a pilot project. And they tanked that thing too. It was narrowed down to southcentral.puff, and anyway, I have a constituent, Scott Hawkins, who took BP, you've been working with those guys, took their supply chain and absolutely saved them up into the billions now of dollars by integrating the volume that they use all together from all their different projects, even across international lines. I think that when you think about transportation, the fleets that you have, the different regions that you have, the amount of dollars, there's no other department that we have that makes the kind of purchases that you do. For the infrastructure, we can do better. The fiefdoms that exist, and you know what I'm talking about. People are very resistant, back to the Anvil comment, to let that go. But with your leadership, we can do it. So I'm going to put in another bill to force you to do it, and I want to work with you on it. Okay? So I leave it there. The next is ferries. We can also do better there. With a little bit more innovation, I've come up with two ideas there. The idea of getting more foot passenger traffic to try and make some money there. One of my ideas is, the Eurail Pass that we do over in Europe. I came up with the idea of a NorPass, a Northwest Ferry Passage, that can link us over to Canada and to Washington State. Market this thing. I've been working with the guys over the years, and there's varying levels of response to it, but that plus merchandise on board, food and beverage to help over to help bring in some of the costs. So I want to talk to you about that in the future. And then my last point that I want to make is the idea of GTL, gas to liquids, and some of the opportunities for natural gas in your fleets. And I think when you look at the gas line and our projects that we're trying to make, you are going to be the volumetric anchor, potentially, with your fleet. So I'm not going to ask you to respond to them. I'm just going to put them on the record that those are innovative ideas to think about with your leadership. And I appreciate you coming forward and agreeing to come back on the job.
Mr. Chair, Senator McGuire, I'll just say I look forward to working with you on all three of those.
Excellent.
What's the other question? Senator Coghill, want to help us dispense with some activity?
Yeah, and I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I would go ahead and make a motion that we report to the body the recommendation that we heard, Benjamin Brown and Vern Rootwright, for the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commissions.
Hearing no objection.
Also, Mr. Chairman, I move that we recommend to the body that we heard Mark Fish, the Alaska Public Office Commission, and as the previous motion, this does not show that we support or not support it, but we did hear him.
Hear no objection.
And Mr. Chairman, for the nomination and the good work of Mark Lucan, Department of Transportation Public Facilities, I recommend that we pass Mark Lucan's name to the full body for consideration, showing that it neither is a yes or a no vote, but that we heard him and pass it on for the full body.
Hearing no objection, the reports will be signed around. And thank you, Commissioner, and the other folks who testified. We're going to go right into, we're going to bring forward the two measures. I can't even remember the numbers of them. I had Mr. Fleener. Gosh, hold on just one moment. We have Mr. Fleener. We didn't forget you. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself? I know you're
technically speaking.
Tell us about yourself and why you feel why you're agreed to be in the line of succession.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the opportunity. I am originally from Fort Yukon and have been living in Anchorage since about 2008. My extended family is also all from Alaska, from northeastern Alaska and Yukon and Northwest Territories. I graduated from the University of Alaska Fairbanks in 1999 with a Bachelor of Science degree in Natural Resources Management, where I focused primarily on moose management. I've completed substantial work towards a Master of Science degree in Wildlife Biology through the Resources and Environment Program at the University of Calgary in Alberta. Unfortunately, I was unable to finish that degree because I was activated by the National Guard two times. I do have a Master of Arts in Intelligence Studies from American Public University. I graduated with that degree in 2013, I wrote a thesis on national security implications of a sound U.S. Arctic policy. In the early days, I served as the first director of natural resources for the Council of Athabascan Tribal Governments out of Fort Yukon. And after receiving my natural resources degree, I became the first regional biologist up there and served in that capacity sometime before becoming the executive director, where I oversaw healthcare, education, and natural resource management for all of the villages in the Yukon Flats. I served from 2008 to 2010 as the director of the Division of Subsistence for the Department of Fish and Game. I then became the deputy commissioner over game, subsistence, and habitat, providing policy oversight on wildlife and subsistence management issues until 2013. I currently serve as the Arctic Policy Advisor to the Governor, where I focus on implementing the Arctic policy of the state of Alaska and coordinating the state's involvement in activities with our federal counterparts. Alongside my civilian career, I've served in the military for about 27 years. I enlisted and served in the U.S. Marines from 86 to 90. Then in 1991, I enlisted in the Alaska National Guard. I served as a 50 caliber machine gunner in supply, and then I became a KC-135 crew chief, and then a maintenance controller. I received a commission and became a maintenance officer with the 168th Wing up at ISN, and then I became an intelligence officer in 2007 and currently serve as the senior intelligence officer for the 176th Wing on JBEAR. In the past, I've served as the deputy mayor for the city of Fort Yukon. I've served as a tribal council member for my tribe in Fort Yukon. I've been a committee member on a National Academy of Sciences committee where we were looking at developing a long-range Western Alaska Salmon Research and Restoration Plan. I've served as the chairman of the Eastern Interior Federal Regional Subsistence Advisory Council, also as a board member for the Alaska Board of Game. I was a board member on the Alaska Native Health Board. I was the director and chairman of the Kwich'in Council International, which serves as a permanent participant to the Arctic Council. And I've also served as a member of the IUCN Bison Specialty Group, having worked on bison issues for a while in Alaska. And as someone who is very proud to be an Alaskan, I say that it's a tremendous honor being asked to step up as the successor to the Lieutenant Governor. I take this request very seriously and believe that I think, as has been demonstrated by my career of public service and mostly jobs associated with serving the public, that when our leaders ask Alaskans to serve, that we need to say yes, of course with prayer and deep contemplation, but I think that it's important when leadership identifies people to step up and say yes. So I thank you very much for this opportunity, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Fleener, are you 30 years old or older?
I am.
Are you a qualified voter of the state of Alaska?
Yes, sir.
Have you been a resident of Alaska for 7 years?
Yes, sir, I am.
Have you been a citizen of the United States for 7 years?
My entire life.
So you meet the constitutional qualifications. I just wanted to make sure. And I have one last one. Do you believe that Governor Walker or Lieutenant Governor Malott will have to have a food taster anytime you're around?
No, not at all.
Okay. I'm through with my questions. Senator Huggins.
Yeah, Mr. Fleener, Charlie Huggins. Moose, you have some credentials on Moose. If you were the Moose Czar, or you were the governor, you're going to declare, we're going to do two things for Moose in the state of Alaska that would hopefully manage us closer to abundance. What would those two things be?
Well, I'm an absolute firm believer in abundance management, and it's hard not to be when we really have a constitutional obligation that says we're supposed to be managing for the maximum benefit for all Alaskans, and it's really hard to ensure that Alaskans are getting that maximum benefit if you're not managing them for abundance. So I think I have actually lots of ideas on how we advance the cause on moose, but of course we need to understand each and every population around the state and what may be limiting their populations. There are good populations, healthy populations in the state as well. I think we take a look at those populations and see what's going right there. In every part of the state, the management implications are going to be different. Sometimes the issue will be predators are too abundant. Sometimes it'll be poor habitat. There's
just an area
selling.
Yeah, Mr. Fleener, Area 16B, which sits on both sides of the Matanuska, or corrections, so sitting in a river. Let's talk about 16B, number one, number two.
I think access is probably one of the big issues over there. We have a high number of predators that are having an impact on moose, and limited access makes it very difficult for Alaskans to access those resources. I think the least expensive way to make sure that we're managing for abundance is to provide opportunities for Alaskans to harvest. So I think I would work on improving access and, of course, managing predators.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you. Any other questions? I think this gentleman is far too qualified to be a lieutenant governor's successor. Is there anybody else wishing to testify on the appointed successor to assume the office of Lieutenant Governor. It's happened twice in Alaska's history, recently in our tenure here with Adjutant General Campbell succeeding, and then previously then Transportation Commissioner Bob, the late Bob Ward, and during pursuant to the Hickel appointment to the Interior. So it's been relevant two times in Alaska history, and certainly that it even took on relevancy even more in 2008 with possibilities of vacancies in the governorship. And so it's a very relevant appointment, so appreciate that we have a qualified successor. Lieutenant Governor Coghill. I mean, Senator Coghill.
That's kind of roll off the tongue, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
Sounds good.
We have an alternate successor appointed there, Craig.
We're going to decide that at the committee level.
With that, Mr. Chairman, I move that we report out of committee Craig Fleener as Lieutenant Governor's successor on our report that shows that we heard him in committee and it's without recommendation.
Only because Senator Coghill doesn't want to do it, we'll venture evil. With hearing no objection, we have one last item before we get to counterman. My apology, everybody that's been waiting patiently on. Mr. Ray was muted and he couldn't get there. He had testimony on a previous nominee. Mr. Ray, are you available?
Yes, sir.
Go ahead and get a little closer to the microphone, speak a little louder, and identify yourself.
My name is Ken Ray, Wasilla, Alaska. I was commenting about the governor's nominee on Fisheries Commission with former Mayor Vern Ruprecht. I would like to commend the man for his effort and hard work, but I have a very serious question about a person who is in a position of authority or as a commissioner in judgment. I would like to see whether or not any statesman will stand up and repeat the words that he uttered at a city council meeting in criticism of a citizen in testimony, and I question the qualities of a person like that in a position of commissioner, and I ask you to reconsider your decision until you have an answer to this question. Thank you very much.
And thank you, Mr. Ray. We have the hearings, and your testimony is now part of the record, and all these commission appointments go to the floor for a vote, and then it'll be up to individual members to weigh the testimony and written and otherwise that you've given. That is part of the record, part of the process, but all appointments do go to the floor. And it was with no commitment to vote yes or no, as the motions indicated. But your testimony is now part of the record.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ray, and thank you for your patience and indulgence of a cumbersome process. Some people say teleconference is just like being there. Not quite, but it is part of it, though. So we can go right to the public testimony on both measures, the counterman amendment and the convention of the state. So our sign up list. Okay, and we're going to first go to Mike Schechter. No, he's here just for questions. Department of Law, Charles Kaprowitz.
Yes, I'm here.
Thank you, sir. And
hello.
Yes, sir. Please identify yourself, your affiliations, and because of and 3 or 4 minutes, if you can confine it into that.
My name is Charles Kaprowitz. I am the executive director for Citizen Initiatives and the Countermand Amendment. We are working to through the state legislatures under Article 5 to amend the U.S. Constitution with the Countermand Amendment for the purpose of restoring our constitutional republic through the sovereign authority that legislatures alone have. We presently have 18 states with sponsors. We have 9 that have filed or are in the process of filing, and we are advancing this in the hopes that by late 2016, this might get ratified and initial countermand initiatives might be started by the states. The idea that we are advancing is based on, one, state legislatures alone are sovereign, that they retain the sovereignty that the nation states had under the Articles of Confederation, that in fact that sovereignty was passed down to the state legislatures today in Article 5 with three qualifiers, one of which is they wanted the new Constitution, which was the successor of the Articles of Confederation. They wanted that new Constitution to be the supreme law of the land. The second is they wanted it to be perpetual so that this generation can enjoy the merits of a sovereign authority through Article 5. And three, they wanted it to be for proposing amendments, not for constitutional conventions. They realized that they had a constitutional convention then. It was for the purpose of creating a new government and a new constitution. And then when they inserted Article 5, it was for the purpose of preserving that constitution by restricting future legislatures to propose amendments to that constitution rather than to have them change the whole constitution in some fashion through a state, through delegates at a convention. So the first thing is there is no such thing under Article 5 for a constitutional convention, contrary to the popular belief for many, many, that for the last 30-some years that have paralyzed the state legislators, preventing us from addressing many, many issues. I mean, we have an $18 trillion debt because the other groups have decided that there was no authority in Article 5 that is safe, and they didn't want us to use it, and they scared the legislators for 30 years half to death, causing 15 balanced budget amendment applications on Congress to be rescinded. So they have literally caused us a lot of debt and a lot of trouble and a lot of issues that were never addressed because Article 5 was not used. Now, I have been in the working to amend the Constitution of the United States under Article 5 for 40 years. I probably have the longest longevity of anyone in the Article 5 arena today. I have worked through Congress as well as through state legislatures. And the Countermand Amendment offers, I believe, the best hope that the legislatures have in restoring our constitutional republic. When 30 states, after it's been ratified, when 30 states countermand a particular law or ruling, could be an energy, it could be environmental, it could be an EPA ruling, it could be some educational issue that the federal government is imposing on the states. When 30 states countermand that law or ruling, even the Supreme Court ruling, it is automatically rescinded. We have to understand that the state legislatures in 1787 created the federal government. The federal government did not create the state legislatures. And as a result, the legislatures today have the same sovereign authority that they had back then with the conditions that I just mentioned a moment ago. Now, the legislatures today could even change that, but they would have to do it through proposing an amendment. And that would be burdensome because probably most states would not want to change Article 5 beyond where it's at right now. But that's the kind of sovereign authority we have. Some of the issues that can be addressed by this countermand amendment by state legislatures include enumerated rights. Unenumerated rights, you're actually going to be able to identify unenumerated rights in the 10th Amendment, even the 9th Amendment, and enumerate them through the countermand. When 30 states countermand that same law or ruling, that law or ruling is rescinded, and now it's a stated position of the many states that that's an unenumerated right. The countermand is a form of nullification, but it doesn't have any teeth until such time that 30 states agree that that particular ruling or law is to be countermanded. Then the teeth become material because that law or ruling is is automatically rescinded. Also, we're encouraging the legislatures to understand that Article 5 is strictly for them. The legislatures do not need the permission of Congress to have an Article 5 convention convened, including the Countermand Amendment. The Congress is simply a facilitator under Article 5. Its purpose is to provide a manageable process that the founders had left for us so that Article 5 can be used safely and successfully in the future. They are not the controller of the Article 5 process.
Okay, Mr.
There is the governor. There's
we'll
a
need to,
there that is advancing the process. Yes, sir?
We'll need to summarize here. We actually have to give up the room here in a few moments.
The summary is that the Countermand Amendment will enable the state legislatures to restore our constitutional republic by having authority to identify and define laws and rulings that are burdensome to the states, and where 30 states countermanding rescind that law, forcing the government to do one of two things. One, abandon the law, or two, rewrite it. If they rewrite it, it'll have to be rewritten, realizing that that too can be countermanded. So it'll create a balance of power between the states and the federal government that will be healthy, and the states will be looked at as respected partners in government rather than subjects to federal mandates. So if that, in summary, is what it's doing. There's no limit as to how it can be applied, but because there are 30 states that are needed for rescission, there's a margin of a supermajority that makes it a very healthy amendment process, a countermand process. The states can initiate the countermands. They can decide that there's a certain law that needs to be countermanded and send out an invitation to the other states, letting them know that they would like those other states to join them on that countermand.
Yeah.
And that becomes a way in which these states can actually identify laws that they want to see rescinded.
We're going to have to stop you here. It's our intent to bring this up again later, and I know this will be vetted. There'll be more testimony in the Judiciary Committee as well. We'll really tear into it. But when we bring it up again, we're going to take the rest of the testimony. We'll start it at the beginning of the meeting so we can give folks more certainty of the timeline. But anybody else, thank you very much for staying with us for a couple hours to testify, sir.
You're welcome, sir.
The gentleman in the back, you've been noticed that. Did you wish to say anything? Just observing, okay. Is there anybody? I know I've popped onto the some of the interactive media. A lot of Alaskans are following this on Facebook forums and so forth. They if they're not testifying, they are listening. I want to acknowledge that I see I've peeked at some of the posts and comments. So our apologies. Our process isn't quite as smooth here in accommodating public process, but it's our intent to. We'll start the next hearing we do on this, Mr. Kuhn, I'm just letting the public know. We still have a couple more minutes. Mr. Coons was going to speak. I hadn't forgotten about you. I just was letting the rest of the world know who's not sitting right here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mike Coons. I am the National Director for Citizens Initiatives. I'm also the State Director. And Charles Kaplowitz is our executive director, our boss out of South Carolina. A couple things I wanted to just touch on, because I know we're running out of time. And I wanted to kind of touch on a couple things that Senator Coghill said on Tuesday. Senator Coghill kind of alluded to this. Charles just kind of talked about it a little bit, but I wanted to expand a little bit more. This amendment will create a partnership that has not happened since about 1900. Which I think is that's pretty much a historical change when Congress really started doing some, and President Wilson. However, this partnership will not be the states partnering and compromising with the centralized government. However, rather it would be the Congress, the House, and the Senate will look to the legislatures at the several states for their direction, as per like prior to Article 17. Or the 17th Amendment, where the legislatures appointed the senators worked for the legislatures. We get that back with this. Of importance, the above is that once a law is repealed, the Congress can relook at that original intent of that repealed law and rewrite a new law that is more clearly defined, not impose mandates, and in the cases of agencies created, that agency shall submit legislative language to vote on and approve by the House and Senate. That could be very easily done at the congressional level. It would then be up to the state legislatures to communicate approval or opposition to the threat of approve it or not and say, yeah, we can deal with that if it's a one-page, two-page bill. If it's another 50 million pages, we're going to countermand it. If this thing passes, as soon as it is signed by the president, we'll have a countermand within 30 days. I I've got down five things, and Senator Coghill again brought up the point about, you know, this is going to be kind of a high bar to meet, and it is. However, based on what has been happening over the last, going back to Jimmy Carter, President Carter, one, no child left behind. It's an issue that is bipartisan. It's bipartisan in nature. None of the states liked it. We could have a state legislatures could write it's a simple resolution to repeal No Child Left Behind. 30 states could do it, matter of one session. Second would be federal lands. I read what I wrote the other day on that. You got the Lands Council that's right down in Arizona now, Utah, Nevada, all those people that are working really hard to get their lands back. We could get 30 states easily. All we'd have to do is probably pull in some of the southern states, and we would have our 30. We could do that again in a session. Anti-Second Amendment. We've got all sorts of things that have been going on since 1934, the National Firearms Act. It would be, again, a simple resolution by 30 states. When you consider we have 40 states now with concealed carry, we got five with constitutional carry, three more right now in the process of going to constitutional carry, we could repeal the 1968 Gun Control Act. We could repeal the 1934 NFA. There's a lot of things that could be happening there and regain our constitutional Bill of Rights freedom. The other one would be EPA. EPA is from Delaware to Oregon, from the Gulf of Mexico to Barrow, has had impact on everybody, on every individual. There's a gentleman up in Montana, built his own pond on his own land, off the stream that was running through his own land, and the EPA turned around and hit him with $7,500 a day because he had a little seepage coming out of it. And he didn't go through the EPA. Again, this is something that could be done, a simple resolution to, you know, look at those EPA rules and regulations that could be resolved in one session. And lastly, Patriot Act. I've got several Democrat friends that's one of the things that they're really concerned about, between that and No Child Left Behind. First Amendment rights. That's First Amendment right across the board. Both Republican and Democrat, both Independent and Libertarian, all across the board, that First Amendment right is paramount, and the Patriot Act is a major concern. So those are that's kind of a follow up some of the comments from Tuesday, and I would entertain any questions.
Well, we're actually gonna stop today. I know you're here in person, and you've been spending a lot of time visiting individual offices. Thank you, everybody that spent the time to talk to you as you've come down here as a citizen lobbyist. It's our intent the next time we bring this up, which will be as soon as I can, we'll do it at the start of the meetings. We know at the time certain we're going to deal with this in respect to the public and deference to the public.
I'll be on the phone to do that. I got a plane to catch on Friday. Yeah. So.
We've treasured your company here, though.
Thank you all.
We'll set this aside, and if there are other Alaskans, in deference to them, we'll keep the public testimony open so they can testify or provide their comments. This is an imperfect process, trying to fit a lot of policy issues into 180 plus minutes a week is what this committee is allotted. So appreciate the patience, even if not the patience, at least the courtesy and politeness of our constituents and the people that this process belongs to, and tolerating the imperfections. And we'll appreciate everybody staying, the incredible deference and respect to the listening to the rest of the public. So thank you, and we'll stand in adjournment, Lieutenant Governor.